Black Talk Radio Network is made possible.
Yes, good evening.
Help from the Black Talk Media Project, a North Carolina-based nonprofit engaged in the production and distribution of independent digital black media. Find out more by going to blacktalkradionetwork.com or blacktalkmediaproject.org and look for the menu tab, Crowdfunding Black Media. Black Talk Media Project, helping to provide you with new black media for the new millennium.
Yes, good evening. Welcome to Race Tree. And I want to welcome our co-host. Excuse me. I want to welcome our co-host this evening at Race Tree, Anaji Moed. And we had decided to come back with Race Treaty and do a debrief on our movements and activities over the summer. As some audience may or may not know, we've been kind of on a sabbatical doing things, and Brother Anaji's been all over the country on a spiritual path as well. And so welcome, Brother Anaji, to what Race Treaty, and you set the agenda, and we'll fill in from there.
Okay, my brother, you know, it's like, you know, taking the ball down the court, you know, just shaking and baking.
All right.
We can do this thing together. But it's good to be back on the air, and it's nice to come back on the air with some real progress to report. I don't know where to begin. Maybe I'll begin with on November the 2nd, UN Human Rights Network, of which we're members, had hosted a meeting with the working group, the United Nations Working Group of Experts on African People. And the agenda for that day was UN Working Group of Experts of People of African Descent meeting with U.S. Civil Society Wednesday, November 2nd, 2016, from 10 to noon at the UN Church Center, and speaking to the committee. A few people were not there, but most of them were there. Speaking to the committee, I had said, I'm going to give my comments inside of the framework of the decade. I'm talking about the United Nations Decade for People of African Descent, where they have put forth three very powerful, very thoughtful, very decisive themes. One is recognition, two is justice, and three is development. And I shared with them that with the matter of recognition, our people of African descent, the new Africans here, have never had nor offered a plebiscite. That is illegal for government to superimpose citizenship, because that is in fact political violence. The first principle of democracy is not only consent but informed consent. And as my teacher, Dr. Imari Obadeli, has taught me and us, he asked the question, when do we give consent? We have never given consent. So with respect to recognition, it has to do with our political status of a captive people, in fact, a domestic colony. And I'm going to get back to that. I'll end with that. The second theme in terms of justice. Justice has to do with, one, finding out how have a people been treated by the state apparatus, and therefore bringing those charges forward, and with those charges being revealed, justice has to come in the form of repair. Repair, another word for repair is reparations, which has three aspects: compensation, restitution, and rehabilitation. And also, we know Van Boven, the Special Rapporteur on reparations in the early part of 2001, said that we need a monitoring system that would keep track of what's going on, because something can be repaired, but if it keeps going on, then what's really happening, right? And then the third part is development. Development around the question of restitution, compensation, rehabilitation, and giving people the platform through which they can develop themselves individually, develop themselves in terms of families develop themselves in terms of communities. And we know quite precisely now, and more evidence is coming forward, how this country, particularly in America, United States of America, has always targeted individuals, has targeted our families, and has targeted our communities. Any level of social development that we had sought to engage in, it was always this response of putting us back in our place. Why? Because in the very beginning of this country, it was always built on the premise of white supremacy. And anything and anybody coming into this country would serve the interests of white supremacy. And that has not changed from the day that it was initiated until today. We have different words and pretty words, but you look at the actions and you look at the results and you look at the suffering of our people, that's the constant. That's the one thing that we can say has been constant in America. So saying those remarks, I was afterwards remembering that what I had left out, which I should say now to this listening audience, the two things I left out which was very important. One was that the 13th Amendment was an amendment not to abolish slavery, but just to alter it, just to bring it into another form of management that gave them a higher level of control. Think about it. If you have captive people who are enslaved and they are working the land, well, how many places can the overseers be? It's more of us than it is of them. So every now and then we had a chance to escape because we can run into the woods and we're gone. When you have somebody between four walls of concrete and barbed wire and guns and everything else, the chances of you escaping is quite slim. So the labor that they extracted from us in slavery was a variable because we could run away, and many of us didn't. In fact, we don't know the total history of the rebellions and the times we ran away, in addition to the way in which we sabotaged the slaveocracy. But when you're in a prison place, not only do you have to, escaping is quite a challenge, but now you're dealing with the pressure of other people being in close quarters that's creating confusion, anger, rage, and therefore more violence. So now you have a conundrum of just dehumanization. So when you come out, if you come out, you're going to be more deranged and angered than you did when you went in. Of course, it's never been a question of rehabilitation. So it's saying that that we have to understand the 13th Amendment, how it has continued, it just has morphed. There was another point that I left out that I had wanted to say, again, going back to Mario Badelli. He teaches us that when the Constitution was put in place, at the very same time, it was a war against Africa. And then the question is, how so? It's so because if you give permission to your citizenry to go to another land to kidnap those people and to bring them into your domain, you have sanctioned war against those people. You haven't said it, but you don't say, I declared war. So it's just the undeclared war that at the very same time American state was created, it was a war against Africa and through extension through African people. So those are two things that I didn't have a chance to say. But I definitely talked about the plebiscite. I talked about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission as far as justice is concerned. We need a forum to bring that forward. And then and reparations are due in terms of justice as well as development. So those are the ways in which I had remarks I had submitted to the working group on the 2nd. So let me stop there, Robin. You might have some questions or some input that you might want to add to that.
Well, yes. I was really, really encouraged that you were able to bring these issues in front of the working group, and the plebiscite being one major, major issue, in that we don't have a state face. We're not at the table on the international level as a nation state. With, in fact, the human rights afforded us under a nation state. Otherwise, we're just individuals. And so bringing that issue up is major, because our identity has changed in my lifetime, I believe, 5 times, from Negro to color to black to Afro to African-American. And none of them indicated state designation as a people. So, you know, I think that's major. One of the reasons why it's major, because corporations are human, but corporations are the structures in which white supremacy rests and rules. And we also know under human rights law, it's about protecting people against the state. And vice versa, we don't really have a premise as a peoples to bring corporations or the system to international courts. I think that's a major issue also. And given the movement towards the decade, I happen to speak this evening with a brother from Sweden who's now in London, working with the decade there, with the European decade. We haven't come together in that recognition. Also, probably the largest portion of people of African descent in the diaspora is in Latin America, you know, and then you have Portuguese, the largest, 10 times more West African slaves came to Brazil than the U.S., Portuguese. So this recognition is our global recognition that we are still working to bring together. Now, there's money allocated under the decade, but it's got to be infused with a grassroots recognition that we are part of a global community that's undergoing the same oppressions. And so that recognition is absolute. Also in recognition comes the fact that we are producing the information ourselves. We're relying on the government to produce information that paints a picture of white supremacy by law, by violations of the law, I should say, in terms of disparate impact and disproportionality. Just yesterday, I believe it was, there was an article that said that the head of the FBI found that, you know, the policing policies and the racism within the policing is regrettable. But he also said something that was an excuse, but also a violation, in fact, that due to absence of reliable data, there's no way that the United States is going to be held responsible for these crimes against people of color, or racism. It's a sidestep. The basis for human rights law is about disparate impact and disproportionality, and yet the United States FBI director says they don't have reliable data, nor are they bound to do so within the system of white supremacy. Under international law, yes. So there's a lot of movement going on, man. I want to speak to those and just kind of fill in a nausea on your efforts, which is major, and what we can see moving forward. Maybe speak to the Human Rights Cities movement that's just evolving, and maybe speak to a workshop that we were at recently where a presentation was given concerning the recognition of the justice and the development in terms of human rights cities and the aggregation of data and a formula for rallying around and organizing around the various areas of people activity with the indicators from those in each city. Can you speak to that, Anas?
I would love to, Robin. I want to thank you for your vigilance and your persistence in terms of liberation struggle for our people, and how you've been so consistent making connections, you know, bringing people together. Bradford in California?
Buford, yes. Dan Buford.
Dr. Buford, yeah. So you're always making these connections, and it was through your invitation to me to present at the Chronic Carolina Human Rights Organizing Conference in Auden, North Carolina, which is adjacent to Asheville. Was because of your invitation to me that I think we have come upon a winning formula. In that, I'm referring to the workshop that we participated in last weekend 2 weekends ago.
Guys, Najee and Robin.
Yes.
Welcome back to the network, first and foremost, and I'm glad that y'all are back. And this is the reason why you are so important to the Black Talk Radio Network family. You guys are putting in real work. You're on the ground. And we're getting this news from you, not filtered through the corporate media, but straight from the witnesses, straight from the participant in this push on the behalf of indigenous people, people of African descent. So it's great to hear both of you lay out the issues for our listeners tonight. And you mentioned the North Carolina Conference. I was not able to attend because y'all know I'm tied to this station, and hopefully we'll be able to hire some people so I can travel. But I understand that Max Parthas from New Abolitionist Radio was there as well.
Yeah, I will certainly touch on that. He was there and made a major impression on me. So, you know, we always can learn new things. His position is that we have been hoodwinked, we have been bamboozled around what we think this country is, what we think it's done or and hasn't done, particularly on the question of slavery. He says slavery is not only still here, but it's in fact in greater enforced than ever before, because the reason why you can go and arrest someone, put them in prison, is because every time they go into a jail or go into prison, somebody's making some money off them. Even if they're found innocent, they have already usurped the power and exploited them by, of course, their lack of ability to earn any income, right, if they were on the outside, the lack of ability to contribute to their family in terms of a sociological way, and the lack of contribution to the community that they could be participating with. So all you have those lost costs, and you add them all up, it's that not only do the state usurp and gain the money, and be it $10,000, be it $50,000, be it $100,000, whatever the amount is of money which they make, it's also taking that person out of commission, and not just in terms of voting, but anything else. So it was really good meeting the brother, and I'm going to come back to him later, but I would like to finish my thought on the conference in terms of the format where I presented for 20 minutes on human rights, looking at CERD, looking at the decade, this creating the context and tying it to the movement for human rights cities, which is now starting to pick up some steam. And the premise is we cannot wait for the federal government to sign nor ratify any of the treaties that they haven't. But in fact, we can do that on a local level, and that makes a lot of sense. It makes sense because people need to have short-term victories. They need to see something in sight that is actually winnable, because so many of our struggles and discussions are so long-term that it's like, why bother? You know, you can't fight City Hall. But if you give people a sight, a target that's within sight, it becomes a motivation. And through that motivation, you can organize people, and through that organization, you can get things done. So the Human Rights City is a movement that's taking place, and I spoke about that. Then the question is, well, what is the state of our people? And we had illustrative Dr. Dwight Mullins, who is a professor at the University of North Carolina, and he spoke to a project that he's been involved with for, I think it's been 6 or 7 years now, of collecting data on Black Asheville and putting it in many of what Robin refers to in terms of people, areas of activity, and he's gotten most of them. I think two of them, Robin can speak to that issue when he's left out, but he gave a presentation on what he's been doing and how that's effective in terms of bringing the information and bringing the assessment forward, so there's no argument about the states of disproportionality, the high numbers of disproportionality, the high numbers of disparities that we as the people have faced, which is really just indicators of our oppression. And then he had 20 minutes to speak. Then Robin, in fact, was the last speaker. In baseball, we call it the cleanup batter. You know, he was the last speaker who brought it home by saying, okay, how now we have this overarching view of human rights. We see how we can collect data. how do you make it real in terms of people, giving them a handle to hold on to and to work with. Every tool, anytime you use a tool, you need a hand to hold it, and you need to kind of, you know, use it. He brought in the tool of the power analysis, sometimes referred to as the foot. Because everybody, you go any place around this country, and you talk to brothers and say, yo, man, take that foot out of my, you know what. So we call it a foot analysis. So Robin and Yafe did a presentation on what is the power analysis, how is it to be used on a local level, and then with those 20 minutes each that we had, we still had 30 minutes left in the workshop. It was an hour and a half. And that was the dialogue. So that formula I'm going to be using over and over and over again, because I think it is sometimes referred to as the master key. And Robin, would you like to add anything to that?
Well, you filled it in great, Anaji. I've got flutters in my stomach because this is large in the common sense of it, in that we have been on a kind of down-low analysis of these human rights laws, especially related to CERD, but how the U.S. Federal government is just totally negligent in knowledge or in compliance with international law that it even signed treaty to, and how also the states are lending a blind eye to the same human rights law, but ultimately understanding the power, because there are three supreme laws of the land, constitution, supreme treaties, and municipal law. And so by rallying on a local level, organizing on a local level, ordinances and human rights law can be implemented locally, as well as a human rights commission, as well as a whole city turning, doing the turnover, as with Jackson, Mississippi, and the movements that you're involved with, Anaji, speaking of human rights cities, to become a human rights cities and adhere across the board with human rights law. So it has to be a grassroots effort. But more significantly, we kind of analyze how efforts are played out in cities, and the fact that, first of all, there's not this information. The motto in Asheville, State of Black Asheville, is in fact a motto that should be placed nationally, and I hope to organize around that, because in fact it's a human rights report. It outlines disparate impact and disproportionality by the data involved in all these areas of people activity. And so you actually get a state or a status of the city's compliance with these various areas of human rights law and these various areas of human activity with that data. And so that's really important. But what we also found, because we did a pilot organizing process locally to Black Lives Matter, in that we broke those various areas of people activity into circles and working groups, which although Black Lives Matter hosted, was open to the public at large. So in education, we had all of these people that were involved on the inside and the outside in circles around localizing the power analysis, which involves just a baseline of who are these characters that are orbiting around our communities in the way of institutions and agencies and government arms. And we want to know names, board members, funders. We want the names. We want the addresses. And we want to go public vis-a-vis this human rights report to these power brokers. And we want to analyze policies and budgets attached. And we found that as a core information process will empower every working group in education, law enforcement, because in these cities, our people are dealing with all these issues, but not always coming together. We're under the institutions of church. We're under nonprofits. We're not really coming together as a consortium, like a unified field. And this organizing in terms of localizing the power analysis actually makes it a very clear, and with the report, with the state of whatever city, but the motto has been formed by Dr. Dwight Mullins, who, by the way, is on sabbatical and has been doing a tour of black colleges, historically black colleges, trying to get this in the curriculum in those schools. But we, in fact, know that it needs to come out or interface with the communities as a report for what it is, a human rights report. And so I'm really excited that we do have a formula that will allow for a critical mass on issues. It will allow for pushing the movement for human rights in the way of human rights commissions and human rights law, and embracing the campaign that, Anaja, you're spearheading with Human Rights Cities. So, you know, that's my feeling on that workshop and somewhat our report to date.
That is, thank you. Thank you so much, Rob. And you know, going back to what Scotty was saying in terms of Brother Maximus,
Max Parthas from the abolitionism. By the way, let me make this clear for our radio audience. We're abolitionists. I don't carry that label, but I live under that label and certainly adhere to that, because there's a continuum historically to being an abolitionist. And that was to slavery, but to expand on it, white supremacy.
I have a quick question for both you guys before you move on, but it really underlines your point, the fact that you were in North Carolina and you talked about the importance of localizing human rights through ordinances. And Robin, you know, and Onaje, I know you don't live in the state, but Governor McCrory and the Republicans moved to take that power away from local municipalities so that they could not enact any kind of rights. That's what HB2 on it was about. Your thoughts? Oh,
thank you for that fill-in, man, because it's even more than that, because they're actively engaged in North Carolina, given the fact we just came from a human rights conference here, but they're actively engaged in voter suppression here like no other state. And, you know, not to be critical of mass movements, because, you know, Moral Mondays and Reverend Barber has that voice and face here that seems to be palatable to white racists, in the fact that they're not embracing the abstract or the institutional racism. They want personal healing. But really, North Carolina is a test case for oppression under white supremacy. Absolutely, my brother.
That is certainly sad news to hear that people on a state level are trying to usurp our rights in that way. But we're going to continue to fight, continue to demand our reparations, and we're going to continue to organize. The only defeat that we suffer is when we give up. As long as we,
you know, to speak to Scotty, like, you know, there's two cities in North Carolina that are human rights city. I don't know what legal mechanism, how that plays out vis-a-vis the state, you know, but I do know that it's already an established in beyond ordinances to be incorporated into the city structure. So there's Jackson, but there's also, I think two cities in North Carolina that are already considered human rights cities.
But that legislation, okay, if allowed to stand, will prevent. Like, that's what the fight over Charlotte. They're talking about LGBT rights. And the failure in the black community is to see how that extends to other issues. It's not just about one group. That piece of legislation that tells you that the people you elect, the city council, the person you elect mayor, cannot pass human rights laws. Come on now. That's like some Nazi type stuff there, man. That's some really great.
I don't know that it said human rights law. It said discrimination.
You can't pass any difference.
You're right. However, you know, 90% of LGBT that are murdered are black, first off. And in terms of Asheville and it being a LGBT somewhat a hub, that crossover in dealing with racism is starting to wake up now, but you know, that fanfare concerning that law also Ole Miss, the historically black colleges are trying to be put out of existence by that law as well. And so you have some real diabolical stuff going on in this state, absolutely. But the human rights movement is not just an abstract. There's actually a report that Anaji will get into further, and that he's about to be sponsored at a conference that already involves multiple cities, which I think includes Pittsburgh, which is strong on the move under human rights banner.
Jackie Smith at the University of Pittsburgh has been the chief advocate for human rights cities, and she's organizing consistently. In fact, I met her at a meeting down in Washington earlier this year. If you go to the U.S. Human Rights Network website, you would see a posting there of which all of the conference participants went on the Supreme Court steps and took a picture. And then we formed ourselves into a national steering committee, and that through that committee we have been invited to what is called Global Justice Goes Local, the emergence of human rights cities, December 8th and 9th, 2016 at Northeastern University School of Law in Boston, Massachusetts, and they still have openings for those who'd want to participate. The program on human rights and global economy presents the 11th Annual Human Rights Institute, and some of the workshops will include Why Human Rights Cities, Making It Happen, Local Human Rights in the U.S. There's a book of Celebration Global Urban Justice, The Rise of Human Rights Cities, and a keynote is going to be given by Martha Davis from the Northeastern University School of Law. And this is 2 days. That's the 8th and also the 9th. And the 9th is going to be workshops, intensive facilitated workshops to delve deeper into the topics discussed on day one. www.phrge.net. That's www.phrge.net. And Elizabeth, she's a lawyer. I think she's a asylum lawyer. In fact, Elizabeth Enen, E-N-N-E-N, is the coordinator. Her email is E.E.N.N.E.N. Northeastern, NORTHEASTERN.EDU. That's E.E.N.N.E.N. at Northeastern.EDU. So I think the program is free, in fact. Have offered some travel scholarships for those who are in the listening audience who would want to go, certainly, and those in the listening audience who are either in Boston or near Boston, I would encourage you to go, because now it's getting the word out and organizing ourselves around these questions of self-determination and self-development.
Well, on the issue of self-determination, Najee, that brings us back to the big picture here, which is the decade, which is really needs to be broken up into benchmarks. As you say, we're talking recognition, justice, and when we go into the phase for justice, I'm talking like global, UN, world courts, lawsuits or appearances around the violations of white supremacy to humanity, to international law. And then you have development, the reparations and the restitution, that element in terms of developing institutions to address our maladies stemming from this oppressive system of white supremacy, which we have many of. In fact, we function as a norm under, the aberrations of white supremacy. So this movement towards the decade with these multiple languages, what are we waiting for, man? I mean, how do we cross this this international global bridge? Because there's activities going on like everywhere, and people are at least aware with less means in these third world countries or Latin America. I shouldn't even use that term, third world, my bad. in Latin America, as they call it. There's people of color, and I've been down there, Belize, Honduras, 40% people of African descent. They're like invisible. And in Brazil, the dynamic there and the numbers there and the population there seems to be invisible to our eye also. And so how do we do this coming together? Speaking of organizing locally, what's going on globally? Now, you have Sister Dawati, who really has been, like, totally accurate in describing her NGO and dealing also with something, one of the maladies of our issue of our people, which is colorism. But can you speak to the efforts that are going on the UN or international level from your travels as well? Because we, as we want to organize grassroots, we also want to keep an eye on and be connected to, obviously, efforts that are going on the international level.
Very important point to, this is worldwide. It's not localized, but we use the local organizing strategy because we can galvanize people easier that way, but certainly linking all the local struggles together. And because it is a decade for people of African descent, which is an international covering, we need to make it our business to make these links. In the very same way that through hook or crook, we got to Durban, South Africa as a delegate in 2001, we some kind of way got there, and one of the most incredible experiences of my life is to see all these black people from all around the world talking through interpreters, be it Portuguese, be it English, be it French, be it German, be it Swedish. It didn't make a difference what it was. We had people in the interpreting booths that was actually giving us that information. So we have to go back to the local level because Dawati, Sister Dawati Garcia, she is doing a phenomenal job. She is the chair of the committee, the NGO committee to eliminate racism, discrimination, and Afrophobia and colorism. And she actually held an event about a week ago celebrating the Durban Declaration. Much of the work that's being done, particularly around racism, came out of Durban. If Durban wouldn't have happened, none of these things would have been happened. And if they would, it would be weaker than it already is. But at that particular event, Roger Warhan was one of the guest speakers. We had the assistant Secretary of Human Rights from New York. I got there late because I was coming from Philadelphia. I didn't hear his speech. And then we had another gentleman who was from in Europe. And the two last speakers, Warham and this other speaker, they spoke about this very benign neglect. They didn't use that terminology. I'm using it. This benign neglect on the decade, because all the offices that should be actually leading it and using resources to fund it, they are held back. They are holding themselves back because they would want this to go away. This is not going away. Our people will be free. Our people will get reparations, and we're going to keep this thing alive. So they shared with us, to the audience, how if it's going to happen, it's up to us. So the international connection is going to be made because we know these people. We have their phone numbers. We have their emails. We're making those kind of connections. Speaking internationally, that this weekend, in fact, tomorrow, we are going to be celebrating the 7th year of Asanta Sekou's liberation exile in Cuba at the National Black Theater. Those of you who are near New York or want to get to New York tomorrow will be a good time to be here because we're going to party. It's called Dance Freedom Dance, right? Because we're going to be dancing, having a good time, and we need to have a good time. As hard as we work, you can't just, you know, all work makes Jack a dull boy, so we got to have some party. And
people, I love it, that, man.
People should know that much of our zest for life comes out of our appreciation for the Creator and that which the Creator has given us. So when we had our harvest economies, we was to help each other. So we had cooperative values that Shakti teaches us. And respect. And then at the end of those harvests, we used to have, you know, we used to have families. We partied for 7 days in a row. Can you imagine? Nobody, you know, on your back, nobody coming to attack you, and you just drumming and dancing. So we're going to have a good time tomorrow night at the National Black Theater in New York.
I'm jealous. I wish I was there, Monaji. I know Scotty's waiting to take a station break real quick, and we'll come back in on the second part of the show, and we may have a guest. I think Mark Parthas may be coming to speak as well with us, Monaji, if you don't mind.
No, that'd be beautiful.
All right, well, let's cue in, Scotty, if you're there.
Yes, I'm here. All right, so let's go ahead and take this station identification break. You're listening to Race Treaty. They have are back from their break, but they really wasn't on break, was they? Because they was out there putting in that work on behalf of the people. So I just want to stress again just how appreciative I am of you two brothers to even know you, let alone sit here and learn from you. So thank you again. We'll be back on the other side. We'll be back on the other side. You're listening to Race Treaty on Black Talk Radio Network. Radio since 2008, providing new black media for the masses.
All right, welcome back. By the way, Scotty, you do requests on these commercials, man?
Say, do I do requests?
And I'm being facetious. I was expecting Marvin Gaye again.
It
was awesome tonight.
Yeah, since then, we've been growing a lot, and a lot of attention been put on the network. So we trying to keep it legal. So especially with your podcast now that we're putting them on YouTube, and you know how the music industry is. They exploit the brothers and sisters, poison our people's minds, and then want to just grab all the money connected to it. So, that's why you didn't hear
that. Yeah, white supremacy. Yeah. White supremacy is the explanation. I get all that. But we got some intellectual property to share that's about our people. And Anaji is one of the caretakers of that knowledge. And brother is not just about showing up at conferences and teaching at major university. He also travels on the grassroots on a spiritual journey from being at the Sundance to retreats. So he keeps that energy flowing in this vision. And so as we go into the second phase, let's continue with your report on the international and how that culminates in a vision, because guess what? The same dynamics that affect us in the U.S. affect black folks like everywhere, and we ain't coming together on this great opportunity in history to address white supremacy in the international arena with a global united front. Because until we get a unified field, we'll never have the critical mass and the power and energy that it will take. Because it's not about asking. Truth and Reconciliation Commission would not be about asking. It would be about bringing the information, that same aggregated data on a global basis to that moment in the whole history of white supremacy and its effect to the international forefront. It's in everybody's mind. Everybody knows it. We've been on this track for a while, and yet now it's a major issue. Racism is a major mainstream media issue with all the abstract antidotes involved. White supremacy is an illegal entity. It's illegal. To find remedy inside an illegal legal framework makes no sense to me. It made no sense to Malcolm X either. He had skipped over all this local yoko, and I'm talking U.S. is that white supremacist system, and go to the international courts. You started the show tonight with the first step, the first major step that will give us the self-esteem, that dignity, the identity, and that is that plebiscite, to become a functional nation state. There's loopholes, and I don't want to call them that. There's laws under international law through the UN that a peoples can declare under self-determination their own identity based on whoever they are under self-determination. And yeah, we still using Jesse Jackson's label. That messes me up. So, but that's another issue. Najee, come on, man, take this.
Yeah, I want to recognize Sister Karan Okorundudu. I think she's from either Liberia or Cameroon. I think she's from Cameroon. She's been working in the United Nations for a number of years, and we've done work on the question of racism for, I don't know, maybe 15 years together. But she's also a member of the Committee to Eliminate Racism, Afrophobia, and Colorism. And she made a recommendation the other day at the meeting, as we gear up for the 55th session of the UN Commission on Social Development, which is February 1st to the 10th, 2017, she made the very astute recommendation that we strongly urge member states, UN entities, NGOs, and other stakeholders to, one, implement intersectional approaches to the eradication of poverty, especially among African descendants, indigenous communities, and other people of color. This is referred to as Sustainable Development Goals, which is about, I think, 30 in total, and she singles out a few of them, particularly looking at 5 and number 10. So intersectionality is an approach that focuses on interlocking systems of oppression and privilege in societal structures and the interlocking categories of identity, be it gender, be it race, be it class, etc. She goes on to promote the psychosocial empowerment and resilience of all, including African descendants. So her strategy is a very acute, a very astute one of saying, as we are now, most of the UN is talking about these sustainable development goals. Okay, fine. In the good goals in terms of how they are conceived. But we're saying inside of that, make sure that you include the decade, the principles of the decade. That is what recognition, that is justice, that is development. Make sure that inside of these sustainable goals, we find ourselves and we find our vision to move our people forward. So she's asking people to organize around that. So we have some strong documents. We have people formulating different approaches, and now it is, as it always has been and always will be, it's a matter of getting to the people. That is going to is talking to people on the ground. Robin, you usually often speak about we could have did a plebiscite at the Million Man March, and why Farrakhan didn't do that, I don't know. Somebody need to talk to the brother and say, hey, but do another Million Man March, but let's not have a plebiscite. So these sustainable goals is a strategy that we, another place we can insert ourselves. So we have Brother Maximum on the line. I want to bring him into it because this brother's been doing, double time, overtime, triple time. Nighttime, daytime, all the time. So this is a nation builder, and certainly Aboriginous that we want to welcome to this program. Welcome, my brother.
Peace, Brother Najee. Peace, Brother Robin. What's happening, Brother Scotty? It's good to hear your voice.
Peace, my brother.
Indeed, man. I'm listening to what you're saying, and I just really had just one question. Have you decided in some way or fashion to include the abolition of slavery into this quest of international conciliation, bringing people together across the globe in this fight.
I'm already 100% for that personally, and it is actually covered in the fact that if U.S. adhere to the law, you know, because slavery obviously is illegal, it's morphed, we get down that rabbit's hole of how they've done it. It's a corporate connection to that. Corporations have human rights. We can't sue corporations for violations of human rights by law. So there's this mishmash of law and technicality, and it's become evident through efforts like yourself and others that, you know, it's illegal. So we're not going to find a remedy, I don't think, by any kind of amendment within white supremacist legal system. I just don't see it. So that is actually an issue that has been brought up. Dr. Rando is pushing that envelope as well, brother. You know that. In terms of the international circles concerning that 13th Amendment. It all fits in under the human rights law, which U.S. is in violation of, even by the working group's assessment of late. There's an expectation that U.S. is supposed to respond, but we don't expect any kind of major social change because the U.S. Constitution lends us no social or economic rights. There's nothing in there about that. And or about protection of children in reference to the school to prison pipeline. They've got an automated system that is actually an industry that commodifies black bodies to make money. And, you know, although they may morph again, obviously, if they do eliminate private prisons, that means we now what? Enlarge public prisons again? So I think that is a lateral transfer. I don't see it as an abolition of the draconian laws that are really pipelining our people as, like I said, commodities.
But it is that small victory that you spoke about earlier, though. That's that small victory. You got to give, you spoke on it, and I was sitting here shaking my head in agreement. Abolishing private prisons is a big step. But the question is right. You are right about what they're going to do, enlarge the public prisons. Okay, so then that's another battle. But in terms of abolitionism and giving people small victories, just like when the prison stock market crashed, they almost went out of business a couple of weeks ago. So that's still, but I wanted to ask Brother Anaje, doesn't the Human Declaration of Human Rights in that international law say that slavery shall be abolished in all its forms? Isn't that in the legal language put out by the UN?
I don't have. I don't know if it's in the. It might be in the.
It is. It is. It is, Scotty. You know that. In fact, it's a crime against humanity. You know, in general. So they have an active crime against humanity going on. It's similar to a genocide in the abstract, cultural, language, otherwise. So they've got all these spectrums that white supremacy works off of. And in terms of human rights law, but who, an individual can go and make that argument to world court with any kind of international condemnation or action. And so the inability, even though they have the working groups, you know, every 4 years now, CERD comes and does this assessment and does this, and it's only every 4 years, by the way, that task force evolves concerning this international law. And there's working groups, you know, that are floating around, and they're holding very high in intake of local information and history. What that culminates in, I'm not sure, because the condemnation of the U.S. don't do nothing, because white supremacy has no shame. So you can't shame them. So we are kind of working the mechanisms and the apparatus by which we've been given, but we're not there with any force. Our real brain trust and leadership is not on the U.N. boards, sitting in these panels, having a representation of our people. So that's a problem. But slavery is a crime against humanity, and that was one of the arguments that I think Boyd
this attorney from Iran took the U.S. to international courts for genocide, as well as in the 50s. It was brought to the international courts for genocide, crimes against humanity. There's no enforcement against white supremacy unless there's a global critical mass to dismantle it. So, you know, that's kind of where our efforts are in somewhat in vain, in the sense that we can aggregate this data, we can present it, we can argue it, we can analyze it, but how do we dismantle white supremacy? Certainly not within the structure of white supremacy.
Yes, that is, you know, I mean, that's one way to look at it. The real question is, how do we build black unity? How do we build unity amongst oppressed people? That's really the critical question, because that's the only way that we'll be able to galvanize intellectual, spiritual, and economic material resources to maintain ourselves. So when we talk about racism, yes, it's also something that's done from the outside, but it's also something that we undo on the inside, that is internalized racism. So both of those aspects of racism, it must be understood. Internal inferiority, how are these things playing out? One of the things that happened at the conference in South Carolina is that sister was there talking about this amendment to erase from state constitutions, if in fact the federal constitution, the 13th Amendment, with, of course, the exception clause. So answering Maximus's question, you know, are we going to use it? We have to, because that's the instrument, that's the legal instrument they're using to keep us in prison, and we have to keep speaking against it. We have to keep challenging it until finally that it actually is, in fact, erased. But we know that's not the final battle, because the final battle is the fact, how do we get from under an empire? Empires usually aren't conquered from outside. Usually empires implode, and signs are already, you know, very much in place. Anytime an empire has to use more force, more police presence than they have in the past, it's not a sign of strength, it's a sign of weakness. It's a sign of atrophy, where they're losing the grip. Why? Because the people are getting educated to what the Federal Reserve is, a private bank that owns the economy, a bank that uses a fiat system where anytime you create a dollar, it automatically creates another percentage in terms of interest. So how are you going to pay for that interest? How are you going to pay for the principal and the interest? And every time you get a dollar, there's always another principal and interest. Well, if you can't, it's impossible. So people are waking up. There's a brother in Philadelphia, Jasper Jones, who had sent me, and I'm trying. He sent me an article where he was this really one. It's on YouTube. For some reason I can't find it. Where the person was given a full, total, detailed explanation of fiat and this whole, you know, corrupt, you know, Ponzi scheme that we're under. And so people are waking up, and we're going to keep on doing what we do to wake them up further. And that's why I'm appreciative of this program. Appreciative of everyone's on it. So I want to thank you very much to all of you and all the work that you do.
I can read to you yes. The actual law, the international law that governs slavery, and it's governed by a number of treaties, conventions, and declarations. Foremost among these is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that states in Article 4, no one should be held in slavery or servitude. Slavery in all of its forms should be eliminated. I personally believe, and many others personally believe, that we can prove that slavery is legal in this country and being practiced and has been practiced now widespread and is spreading across the globe using the same systems. No one has fought
slavery. We got to prove it. We got to prove it within a decade, brother. We got to prove it within international courts, within world courts. We're not getting remedy inside white supremacy. And my final say on the race treaty tonight is kind of pessimistic, but I'd like you to know, whoever you vote for, white supremacy stays in power. So, you know, let's deal with that issue too, in the sense that we're seeking remedy in the wrong structure. I want to sign off and thank Max for piping in and bringing up that factor, the major factor that's taken the majority of our black males between 18 and 35 and basically warehouse them from society as a non-factor, emasculated and dysfunction in society, disenfranchised. I personally feel all of that. So I want to thank you for that part in this show tonight. Najee, sign us off, brother.
Well, Aluta Kantanua, you know, long live Asafa Shakur, and let's party hardy.
Peace.